This is Border Patrol, a weekly conversation with the new music artists who are shaping our 21st century sonic landscape. Border Patrol comes to you from the Classical Music Initiative, which is a service of American Public Media. It's funded in part by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. My name is Glenn Zuckman. I'm a visual artist in Los Angeles. I'm joined by my co-hosts, multimedia percussionist Amy Knowles, who's also the executive director of the California Ear Unit, and composer Martin Herman, who's also the artistic director of Long Beach's Downtown Opera. On this week's Border Patrol, Mapping Music, we'll visit with Lemur, the League of Electronic Musical Urban Robots founder, Eric Singer, and Radio Wonderland impresario, Joshua Freed. In both of these interviews, the idea of mapping comes out. It seems like it's a really powerful idea. Can you explain what mapping is?
What it involves is simply taking some kind of process, and it could be something like tuning of a piano, tuning system, lots of different tuning systems, any kind of system like that, and mapping it to something more concrete with a concrete output result. So in the case of a tuning, you take a keyboard and then you say, all right, I'm going to map equal temperament to it. And you do that, and then you get composers who become very excited by that, like Bach was, and he writes the Well-Tempered Clavier, which is a series of two volumes, 48 preludes and fugues each, in which he's exploring that mapping. He's writing music for that tuning system. It allowed him to go to all 12 possible keys, major and minor, because of that particular tuning system. Something that was not possible in terms of harmony and musical ideas and other kinds of tuning systems. So that's one kind of mapping. And the kind of mapping that's going on with Singer and Freed, I think, is the idea of taking a computer, a process, which you can model on a computer. So that's unfolding in time, and then you can map that into a musical output in some intelligent way.
So when I go to a piano, different mappings or different tunings, I might sit down and hit keys and get different results depending on how it's been tuned or if
Absolutely.
It's a prepared piano or whatever
definitely.
It is.
Yeah.
But now in the digital realm, that number of possibilities just goes through the roof in terms of what can be mapped to what.
Certainly.
Yeah.
And it seems like Singer and Freed are both making some effort to let the mappings not be completely arbitrary, but let there be some degree of intuitiveness so that an audience can connect to action and sonic result.
That's right. Mm-hmm. It's very much tied in. The mappings are very much tied in with live performance situations, which are very risky. but can be very exciting. Amazingly fascinating things can happen when you're taking real-time radio, FM radio, and using mm-hmm. that as your source material, and then taking these computer processes and then mapping one on the other, and then performing, interacting with those mappings on the fly. So what's happening in Freed's case is that you've got a computer processing all this data coming in, and then he's performing and determining how the mapping is going to be heard by the audience. And Singer is very much, well, you said yourself earlier, an instrument builder. And he is an enabler. He designs these environments and then invites composers to come
Correct.
Into those environments and create music mappings, if you will,
mm-hmm. yeah.
with his system any way that they like. So he's an actuator and a builder and an engineer, but also a practicing musician. As you said, he plays saxophone and he performs. So he has, you know, he has his hands in both areas. And that's what we're seeing these days is that the engineer composer computer mm-hmm. artists, composer are becoming closer and closer. And when you think about it, you know, it was no different for Bach and Beethoven in those days because they would tune their own pianos. They were dealing with their own technology mm-hmm. in a fairly sophisticated way. You have to have a really remarkable ear to tune a piano.
And
I know from personal experience. So that idea of a composer being involved with technology and the evolution of technology is not a new one.
I'm thinking about something like Terry Riley's Padua concerts. Hmm. Which were all done on a special tuning on the piano. And I believe he was basically improvising. And it's absolutely heavenly music. It's really, really gorgeous. And I think of Harry Partch, his intonation system, his tuning system, and building all these instruments based on that is very similar to what's going on with Eric and Joshua.
It's fascinating to think how these, you know, compressions of air get mapped into some sort of sensory, emotional experience for us. And
that is commonly shared. If you hear a major chord, it's happy. If you hear a minor chord, it's sad. A diminished chord is frightening. That's accepted.
It is. Now, in visual art, colors mean one thing in one culture. You go to another culture and the colors mean very different things. But in music, you think there is a some kind of a substrate that, that humans share?
It's in Western culture, it seems that way. But I'm just thinking now singers.
I was at a lecture recently where Brian Eno was speaking, and he was talking about, it was a very interesting point, he was saying that apparently there's been a lot of research on cross-cultural musical mappings and wondering what, if anything, is consistent among them. And he put forward the idea that the one thing that seemed to remain consistent throughout all of these is the idea of one thing staying the same, some loop, some melody, whatever it happens to be, and then something moving on top of that in some variation over time. So that seems to be that's a consistent musical mapping that goes across culture that is relevant in world music.
So theme and variation.
Sort of like that. Yeah, I mean, you could call a lot of different things. You could ostinato, you know, where you have a repeating pattern over and over and some variation over that. The
sounds
second
like
time
pop
it
music.
Comes around. Yeah, right, exactly. Sounds like a lot of music.
I spoke to Perry Cook from Princeton, and mm-hmm. one of his grad students did a computer analysis of music that he liked, and his terms for pattern and variation were boredom and fear.
Right.
And this grad student determined that he liked music that was 40% boring and 60% frightening. That was
really,
the equation that worked
really
for him.
But it's also all about, you know, in terms of mappings, it's also about controllers. And the sonic banana, as he talked about in the interview, is a controller. And basically what it's doing is just sending out bend messages to the computer. And if the controller is going to survive, that is, if that instrument is going to survive over time, there will have to be music written for it that uses it, that resonates. And so that's going to take time. You know, one
so
in
now
terms of the survivability.
But now I assume that also maybe a specific controller isn't necessarily going to survive, but it's whatever physical way a given performer wants to move to generate sound, so that one person might use a sonic banana or a steering wheel or drum on shoes, and that these are just three of myriad choices for how you can actuate sound mapping.
Exactly.
You go to Radio Shack and you can create your own musical instrument, definitely. But there's also a large number now of boxes that are designed to take any sort of analog input and convert it into a digital message that your computer can understand. So you could put a contact microphone on a frying pan and that could end up triggering a sound from your computer that is of a whale singing or anything that you could imagine. I saw a young composer who's recording ants. It's beautiful.
Well, we tried to fly out to New York to interview Eric Singer and Joshua Fried, and we found that while we were going to be there, Eric Singer was actually here in California doing a huge installation at the University of California Irvine Beale Center. So before our trip to visit Joshua, we raced down to the Beale Center to interview Eric. We'll listen to that interview first. Who is Eric Singer?
In one day, I saw his work with an electronic drum kit triggering animation. And later that night, he was playing ska saxophone in a club. And you have to look at Eric's deep involvement in what he's doing. With the Madagascar Institute, these guys go out at midnight on the streets of New York and play flaming robot ball polo on the street. This is their fun, too.
So there's a certain, dare I say, Burning Man aesthetic hovering somewhere.
Definitely. But it's really a part of his life, I think.
Well, why don't we head down to the University of California Irvine Beale Center and visit with Eric Singer.
Rawhide.
Thank you. This is Glenn Zuckman at the University of California, Irvine's Beale Center for Art and Technology. I'm here with my co-host, Amy Knowles, and we're here with Lemur, the League of Electronic Musical Urban Robots founder, Eric Singer. Eric Singer, welcome to Border Patrol.
Thank you very much, and thank you for getting the group's name right on the first try.
That doesn't often happen.
Not often.
Well, the group has an opening here at the Beale Center in a couple of hours. How many robot musicians and what are they going to be doing?
Well, I haven't actually counted them all. There's so many. I think it's about 40. And they will be performing and interacting. We will be playing them from computer. We'll be letting them play themselves a little bit. And we're going to kind of sit back and discover what they do tonight because we haven't really run them all together at all at this
Ever.
Point.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so it's going to be a discovery experience for us.
Finding out the orchestration.
Right.
And
right.
Do you know, will this be the largest ever performance by a robot ensemble?
I never bother to look that stuff up, and people always ask me. But,
it must be up there anyway.
It's up there. It's probably not the largest, because there are people who have done some pretty large-scale musical instrument installations. But it would be, I would guess it would be up there. It would be one of the larger ones.
And why don't you just describe one of these robots for us? You have all different sorts, percussion and guitar, but tell us what one of these things looks like,
Sure.
what it is.
Well, when we say robot, people immediately think humanoid, your typical Lost in Space type robot or like C-3PO type robot holding onto a guitar. And that's sort of the opposite of what we do. In fact, we say we don't really make robots that play instruments, but robots that are instruments. We're actually designing the robotic mechanisms from the ground up with the instrumental mechanisms. So at the same time, we're creating new kinds of instruments. For example, GuitarBot, it's based on a guitar. It has guitar strings on it. But the similarity almost stops at that point. It doesn't look anything like a guitar. It has four long metal rails on them, and each one is a single string slide guitar type unit. And so it doesn't sound like a human guitarist particularly. It doesn't really even try to. It's its own kind of instrument. Now, in this installation, we have mostly percussive and sound art type instruments. So there are beater mechanisms playing various types of percussion instruments that we've created. Since we work around metal shops a lot, we have a lot of scrap metal, and so we're often auditioning pieces of metal around the shop to see what they sound like. And in fact, if you saw one of us in Home Depot, we would be the people that would be playing the hardware. And you know,
I've often thought that Home Depot was actually the world's largest art store, even though they didn't know it, and perhaps they're also the world's largest music store
and junkyards.
Yeah.
Eric, you did your undergraduate work at Carnegie Mellon,
yeah,
aka Robot Mecca. Did you come there thinking about robots, or did hanging out in the world of Hans Moravec at all influence you, or how did that develop?
Well, I didn't actually hang out in the robot world when I was there. I was a computer engineering student, and when you're a computer engineering student at Carnegie Mellon, you don't do much besides hang out and work, you know, in that department. Though I did get to take some classes in the music department, and I did get to take computer music classes with Roger Dannenberg, who's one of the top computer music researchers in the world. And back then, I wasn't really thinking much about robots at all, but I was thinking about computer music and electronic musical instruments. And in fact, for one of Roger's classes, I built my first computer musical instrument, which was a MIDI saxophone.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And then, interestingly, I was back at CMU last year, showing Lemur's robots, and Roger was in the audience, and it was nice to kind of come full circle from my first instrument to my most recent instrument. And in my mind, it solidified this lineage that I'm really kind of operating in a tradition of musical instrument makers. And if I'd lived a few hundred years ago, I might be someone building, you know, violins or brass instruments or something like
glass
that, and
creating harmonicas. You
know, right, creating strange acoustic instruments. But now I'm creating strange electric instruments instead.
You know, the last time I saw you, you were playing ska saxophone and using an electronic drum set to manipulate animation within a computer. You know, environment. And now you're manipulating physical objects. What drew you out of that computer?
Why did I jump out of the box?
Yeah.
In other words. Well, my interest in engineering started out really in hardware and electronics and, you know, the smell of solder in the morning and that kind of stuff. You know, I graduated from Carnegie Mellon, and at that time, it was kind of difficult to do hardware. You didn't have these off-the-shelf microprocessors that you could, you know, for a few bucks, you could hook up to a computer and program them and get circuit boards printed by going out on the internet. You upload a, you know, a circuit design, and 3 days later, boards show up on your door. It's just so much easier now to do it. So after Carnegie Mellon, I kind of went into software for a while and did a lot of computer music software. Got into a program called Max for interactivity. It's an interactive programming environment for MIDI, computer music, digital audio, and digital video now. And so for many years, I did a lot of Max work and interactivity in that. Then it started to get easier again. Companies started coming out with these microprocessors. You could just hook them up and program them. There you went. So then I started building musical instruments again, wireless MIDI glove, which I used in a performance to play cartoon samples and control kitchen appliances, set off pyrotechnics, this kind of stuff. I have an instrument called the Sonic Banana, which is built from a rubber tube. It's played by bending it various shapes and directions. I'll be playing techno on it tonight in tonight's performance. And so, you know, I got back into building hardware and instruments that humans can play. And then shortly after that, I started thinking, well, you know, those are kind of MIDI output devices. And well, what about MIDI input devices? Kind of reverse the equation. So you could, instead of playing something and it spits out notes, you spit notes in and it gets played on a physical instrument. And so that led to musical robotics. And I thought maybe others might be interested in that idea. So I started talking it up with my friends and colleagues. And pretty soon I had a group of people interested in
And this is somewhere
this.
In the New York City vicinity?
This is, yeah, in Brooklyn. I operate out of a shop called the Madagascar Institute, which is an art collective I co-founded many years ago with a couple of people in New York. It has absolutely nothing to do with the country of Madagascar. My partners picked that name for some reason.
You're listening to Border Patrol from American Public Media. This is Glenn Zuckman with my co-host Amy Knowles. We're speaking to Lemur founder Eric Singer. Eric, it's interesting, you mentioned a minute ago that hardware used to be a big project and it took a long time and now it's gotten easier.
Yeah.
And I'm just sort of wondering, you know, in this amazing tech era that we live in, what does all this technology allow music to do and what does all this technology demand that music do?
Well, since people started making music, they made it with what was available. And if you want to keep moving forward in new musical possibilities and new sounds, you look for new ways to do it. And technology, to me, is just a tool for this. It's the means to the end. We always get asked this question, well, are robots going to replace human musicians? It's the same kind of silly question that happens. It's happened in music technology before, and it's happened in every other kind of industry where technology comes along. Certainly, we're all musicians in the group, so we're not looking to make ourselves obsolete. And we've had...
At least not too quickly.
No, but I mean, the best time that we've had in the group has been collaborating with other musicians and composers, getting people to come in and write pieces for them. And when composers do work with the instruments, they've in all cases, they've approached them as if they were working with new kinds of instruments. I mean, when they retuned the piano in Bach's time and they made it equal tempered, he got very excited about that. It was a new technology. And so he exploited the technology in that instrument by modulating and writing in all keys and this kind of stuff. And so when the composer comes and works with the guitar bot, I teach them kind of the normal mode where if you plugged a keyboard into it, you could play a key and it would pluck and play that note. And if you let go, it stops the note and I go da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, right? And they see that and they go, oh, cool. Okay, now how do I break that? How do I get behind the scenes? And so then I give them the software control panel where they can actually go down to the level and use parameters for the servo control algorithms that control the pitch and the internal feedback algorithms and use those elements as musical compositional elements. So by playing with servo control, you get these kind of rubbery kind of glide effects. And you can spin the pick wheel manually and, you know, do tremolo effects and these kinds of things. So the composers always want to get under the hood and exploit the new things that the instrument does that humans don't do. And I also think of these as like, you know, they some in some cases, in a lot of cases, maybe they resemble instruments that humans play, but you know, they can do some things better than humans. Humans can do some things better than them. But the point is that they do things differently. You know, the guitar bot doesn't sound like a human guitarist, and it doesn't try to. It's a new kind of instrument. And, you know, we have all these percussive instruments. They play like humans, but they don't sound like humans playing.
And so they can play a lot faster, I noticed.
It seems to me that except for synesthetes, that once upon a time, vision was vision and audition was audition.
Right.
And that now that we live in this world where everything is data and algorithm, that maybe any given data set or maybe any given algorithm can manifest as vision or audition or some other aestheticized sensory experience.
Well, there's programs out there too, like Metasynth.
Yeah.
People were using that, take an image and turn it into music.
Yeah, I saw a fantastic piece. I wish I remember who the composer was, but it's a piece that was done at UMass Lowell, and it was based on Mondrian's Broadway Boogie Woogie. He'd taken that photograph and he put it into this visual sequencer and mapped the colors and the locations on the picture into sound, but he'd done an intelligent mapping. I mean, he'd constrained it in such a way that it was musical, and then he played back this painting. And it sounded great. It did not sound like just white noise. It really sounded organized.
You know, the funny question that makes me wonder about is that when we originally, you know, at whatever time in history, developed these sensory modalities, the way that you knew if the mapping was right is that if you looked at some berries and decided to eat them or not eat them, and you ended up either getting fed or getting killed, the mapping that gets you fed would be considered correct, and the mapping that gets you killed would be considered wrong.
But
in this aesthetic space, that obviously doesn't exist. And so, I mean, how do you sort of evaluate these mappings?
I think you evaluate them by deciding whether you like the results.
Just that big human aesthetic processor.
Sure, right. You know, to me, good music is the music I like, and bad music is the music that I don't like. I mean, there's some stuff that you appreciate because of what went into it, perhaps, though you may
conceptual
not like
or
the
technical
conceptual,
or
right, but you may not like the end result. But mostly, I mean, if I'm creating work, I have to be my worst critic at the end, and I have to like what it is. And I'm also, you know, extremely cynical and jaded person, so I'm not impressed by much of anything. So I figure if I can impress myself, then other people probably like the work too.
We're going to New York this weekend to interview Joshua Fried. Can you talk to us a little bit about the collaborative process with him?
Joshua was incredibly brave to be the first composer to work with us.
Oh, he was the first.
Yes, and he started even before the instruments were complete, and he wrote the first piece for GuitarBot. So he could give us feedback on what he needed as a composer, and we could code that in. The bad thing is that we were still coding up until the last minute of producing the piece and working out bugs. You know, he powered through and he wrote, great music, really surprising music to us.
Beautiful.
Because I've known Joshua for a long time and I really love his work, and it was great to collaborate. And we would bump into each other, you know, every year or so at an event saying, oh, we got to do something together. And then eventually this project came along and I said, Joshua, you've got to come compose for a robot.
You're listening to Border Patrol from American Public Media. This is Glenn Zuckman and Amy Knowles at the University of California, Irvine's Beale Center for Art and Technology. We're speaking with Eric Singer, the League of Electronic Musical Urban Robots founder. Can you talk a little bit about the Sonic Banana?
That's an instrument that I made out of a rubber tube. And when I'm talking in academic papers, I say the idea was build a minimal sort of instrument and explore the mapping possibilities. And it has four sensors in it that you bend, and you can bend it into particular shapes and gesture with it, create different kinds of sonic possibilities. The reality is I was sitting around with a bunch of bend sensors one day, and maybe there was a rubber tube kind of lying off to the side, and I thought, gee, I could turn that into a musical instrument. And so I did. In a way, it was sort of a lark, but then it became so fun to play. You know, I just kind of went out there and started showing it to people and putting it into people's hands and letting them do what it does. And what it does is entirely based on the software that it's plugged into, because though I call it the Sonic Banana, it produces no sound. It produces four streams of bend data. It says, you know, how much are you bending at the 2-inch mark and the 4-inch mark and the 6-inch mark, like that.
How does that translate musically? Can you give us an example?
Well, the first couple of programs that I wrote for it, one was an arpeggiator. So you have control over the chord that's being played and the pitch steps and pitch bend and speed and things like that. And so each bend point is mapped to a different parameter in the arpeggiator. And you can sit there and bend at one point and know you're going to control the speed, and bend at another point and know you're going to do pitch bend. Where it gets really interesting is where you forget about all of that stuff and you just bend it into shapes and go, oh, well, this shape makes this particular musical gesture. You kind of decouple the algorithm from your head and just sort of play it. And so, you know, when I hand it over people to play, I typically don't explain what it does and just let them discover. So that was one algorithm. Another one was sort of a harmonica simulation where you have to, or maybe an accordion is a better description, you have to pump it up before it makes sound. And it uses some physics formulas in there to kind of simulate wind pressure and kind of pumping up the sound. And now the latest thing that I do on it is I hook the bend streams up to effects processors inside of a program called Ableton Live, and I'm playing back a techno piece that a composer named Jen Scaturo created for me for this instrument. And so I play it, and I can step through the arrangement of the piece and change what you're hearing by controlling the effects processor. So it's a completely different kind of playing mode. I'm more of a kind of hybrid conductor performer in that case.
It's interesting you talk about not telling people the algorithm, that you want to decouple that and just let them experience the bending of the object.
Yeah.
I spoke to computer scientist Andrew Glasner this past summer, and he made the comment, when I have 14 tails, I'm not going to want to control them with a pop-up window. And he was talking about the note. He did some hang gliding, and he said, you know, the first 15 times I did it, I was paying a lot of attention to moving this and pushing that. And the 16th time I jumped off the hill, I didn't remember any of that. Just for 6 seconds, I was flying. And that big distinction between being sort of aware of, tell this servo motor to do that, versus being organically, as we are humans, sort of immersed in that music-making process.
Sure. I mean, it lets you use your own natural feedback process of cause and effect. Well, oh, this does this, and I do it a little more this way, and this does this. I'm a saxophone player also, and so I spent a lot of time on sound production techniques and exploring, you know, how you create different tones on the sax. And it's a very subtle and intuitive process, and it's very difficult to explain from the teacher to the student. If you want to get a deeper, richer tone, you need to open your throat, right? Well, how do you open your throat? Go ahead, Amy, open your throat. No one really knows what that means, but it suggests something to your brain, and it gets your brain working and moving the motors in your throat, and eventually you do something, and it kind of gets embedded in your motor memory, and you go, oh, boy, that makes my tone much richer. So next time I'll do that, I'll go, ah, and my tone will be richer. So, you know, that's how I discovered certain ways to play the saxophone better. Can I teach that to someone? Can I go to another sax player? Oh, you know, if you want to make your tone richer, you just need to open your throat more. Well, so, you know, if I hand the sonic banana off to someone and I say, well, if you twist it around twice at a spiraling 45-degree angle at increasing, you know, whatever. No, just here, take it and bend it and see what it sounds like. And then if you give it to a little kid, they'll go, and they'll give it a little bend, and they'll go, oh, cool. And they'll tie it into a pretzel and see what that does. And they're like, oh, it's not supposed to do that. No.
We're here at the UCI Beal Center for Art and Technology, where you're having an opening tonight. And I was just thinking about Center for Art and Technology, that really, it seems like a lot of universities now are developing facilities like this. And certainly art and science have had a long history together. But do you think this art technology, are we in some sort of new renaissance?
Yeah, I definitely think we are. There's so many people just getting interested and involved in that as a field. And, you know, there's something to, you know, say, well, why can't it just be art? Why does it have to be art and technology? Well, yeah, but, you know, technology obviously is playing a very important role in this, and it has its own peculiarities and requirements that come along with it to make art that is utilizing and based on technology. You either need to wear a lot of hats yourself, or you need to have a lot of help as an artist, engineers, and technologists. And you also need people, you need to find a common language, and that can be a real difficulty. And so I think centers like this help marry those worlds and find some common ground and hook people up together that need to be hooked up to generate the works.
Eric Singer, founder of LEMUR, the League of Electronic Musical Urban Robots, Thanks for patrolling the borders of new music with us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
And good luck at tonight's opening.
Thank you.
You're listening to Border Patrol from the Classical Music Initiative, a service of American Public Media.